wishing all Radio Aryan listeners
a happy Christmas
and a diversity-free New Year.
Happy Christmas from Radio Aryan. Have a pro-white Christmas and a diversity-free New Year. And remember, a kebab is not just for Christmas. Listen to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and this is the last Truth Will Out Radio program for you of 2016. We've got one day to go until it's New Year's Eve, but we're here tonight and we are here live. And I have with me, of course, Mr. Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told. And also we have with us Messerschmitt, who is now producing his own videos. We do recommend you go out and check out Schmidt's Axis War Heroes, Leon de Grel, if you haven't done already. Dennis, how are you doing today on this fine winter's evening?
I'm doing fine. I'd like to wish everybody out there a happy new year, prosperous, and hope all the wishes come true. We made it to the end of 2016. Good job.
Yeah, and we've actually got a list of some of the best things about 2016 that we're going to talk about tonight after Schmidt's presentation. Schmidt, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing quite well, thanks. We had a kind of strange Christmas weather, but I had a nice Christmas for myself. And I'm looking forward to the new year.
And I know you've been hard at work on this presentation as well. And we've also got the audio track ready for the next video presentation. So there should be one of those coming up soon as well. It's a little bit shorter than the last one, isn't it? I think about half an hour long. And who is it again? Please remind me.
Yes, it's about Jochen Peiper. It's not going to be the full 2 hours like the de Grel video. But I can't promise when it will be ready. I will have to look for footage and, maybe in a month, but I can't make any promises. Maybe sooner.
Well, at least we've got one. You've got one for the listeners tonight. It's part two of your Günter Prien presentation, isn't it?
That's right.
Excellent, excellent. Do you want to proceed?
Yes, I'm going to quickly recap as usual. We were talking about how Prien grew up in the Weimar Republic and how depressing those days were for Prien as well as for most other Germans. I explained how he came to be a sailor and how he loved the life of a sailor despite the hardships, how he became a licensed captain in the merchant navy and yet became unemployed, and how that led to his participation in the voluntary Reich Labor Service. And now, how he joined the Kriegsmarine and his experiences in the war. In 1933, while still with the labor service, he got news that the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, was looking for merchant Navy officers to retrain as soldiers. There was no hesitating for Prien, as his longing for the sea had never really left him. After basic training, he served on a light cruiser, and in 1937, he attended the U-boat school in Kiel. In the first few weeks there, he learned all about the theory of submarine warfare, and then finally, theory was put into practice. He was posted on U-3 as a officer candidate. In spite of all the theory, he found the experience of climbing down the hatch into the belly of U-3 quite bewildering. Bright white light was mirrored in glass, nickel and brass. There was a tangle of electric wiring, air pressure tubes and hand wheels. The noise from the diesel engines was deafening and the space was very tight. They were introduced to the LE, or chief engineer, who instructed them in the handling of a U-boat. Soon after that, Preen experienced the first submerging of the boat. It was put at the bottom of the sea, 22 meters below the surface, and they had lunch there. He soon got used to the daily routine on submarines, but he always remembered his first experience very sharply. In 1937, he became 1WO, or First Watch Officer, on U-26 of the Type 1A, serving under Werner Hartmann. I don't think there is an exact equivalent of the 1WO in the English-speaking navies, but the function is basically that of a second-in-command to the commander, and he's responsible for the steering of the vessel. The name Werner Hartmann may have sounded familiar to regular listeners. It was the same Hartmann who was involved in the Laconia incident, which I talked about some weeks ago. Hartmann told him that for the moment he had no use for him and suggested to him that he take a week of leave, which he did. On his way back to Leipzig, he met an ensign who showed him a photograph of a New Year's ball. He saw the blonde girl he had kissed in the garden of a villa, which I recounted last week. He asked the ensign for the address of the girl and wrote a letter to her. Soon a reply came back. The girl thanked for the letter and wrote that she had been quite amused by it, but that she had never been in Plauen, where Preen had kissed that girl. Regardless, the girl, the one he had written the letter to, became his wife half a year later, and he never regretted the mix-up. After his short leave, Hartmann told him that they had been ordered to cruise to the Spanish coast. In a hurry, U-26 was made battle-ready. Provisions, fuel, torpedoes, and shells for the deck cannon were brought aboard and stored. This was the time of the Spanish Civil War, and encounters with Soviet supply or warships could have turned hostile. The very next day, they left port for Spain. When they were in the English Channel, drills were held, and Preen was reminded that serving aboard a submarine could be dangerous even when no enemies were near. The order was given to dive, and all stations had reported clear for dive. The order then was then given to flood the tanks, but then someone was yelling in the bow compartment, "The eel, the eel!" And the German U-boat crews informally called the torpedoes eels. Preen ran to the bow and saw that a torpedo was hanging out of its tube. Four men were holding it back, but if the boat would tilt even more to the aft, they would be crushed. Preen ran a few steps back and yelled to the LE what was happening. He immediately understood, and the diving plane was adjusted, averting the catastrophe. The responsible crewman was found. He admitted to having given the clear for dive too soon. Werner Hartmann gave him a stern dressing down, which in Preen's word made, quote-unquote, the curtains wobble. By breakfast time, however, things were already smooth again. It was not the only dangerous incident. They got into the worst storm Preen experienced on a U-boat, at least up to the time he wrote his memoirs. The waves were so high that they were rolling over the crewmen, which were on watch on the tower, and one man almost went overboard when his harness broke. Hartmann was able to grab him in the last second and save his life. Hartmann decided to continue their cruise underwater, and when they surfaced again, they saw the Spanish coast in the light of dawn. They could faintly hear the thunder of artillery coming from the coast when the wind was just right. When they were cruising near Bilbao, they spotted two warships, a cruiser and a destroyer, the Almirante Cervera and the Velasco, as it later turned out, two Spanish Navy ships. They were heading straight for U-26 and were training their guns on the submarine. Hartmann concluded that they must be taking them for a Soviet submarine. He decided to show them his broadside, stop the engines and have the Reich war flag raised, and to keep signaling them in Morse code, Alemann, Alemann, the Spanish word for German. They kept heading straight for them, however. "Quite a sticky region here," Preen said, and loosened his collar, which made Hartmann laugh. A And then finally, the Spanish ships started to veer round and their guns moved back to zero position. They saluted their German allies. In December 1938, he was promoted to Kapitänsleutnant and finally given his own command, U-47 of the Type 7B. He stepped in front of the assembled new crew. He greeted them with Heil Besatzung. Besatzung means crew. And they replied with Heil Herr Oberleutnant. He told them, quote, in a few days we will put into service a new unit of the German Kriegsmarine. I expect every man to do his duty as I will do mine. If this will be the case, we will get along just fine. End quote. The crew were all volunteers to the U-boat Waffe. They were hoping to experience more than the daily routine on a battleship, according to Preen. During the first half of 1939, they were getting acquainted with the U-47 and each other during several training exercises on the open sea. They were on another exercise patrol in the Atlantic when the news of a possible imminent war began to reach them. Preen remarked that the crew was getting a little sloppy in their attitude towards the drills, and a lot of political discussions went on between the crew members. Quote, but deep inside, we did not believe there would be war, at least not on a large scale. For the thought that the great peoples would again butcher each other was too absurd. But then it came after all. End quote. The special announcement came over the radio. War with England. Everybody on board fell silent. The officers were looking at Preen, who went to the maps and, ordering a new bearing of 220 degrees, he pointed to a location on the map. Here is where I want to operate. From the stern of the boat, a sailor could be heard. Quote, may God have mercy on those guilty of such a war. End quote. The very next day, they sighted a steamer. Preen gave the order to go to periscope depth, and when the steamer was close enough, U-47 surfaced and fired a warning shot from the deck gun in front of the steamer. The captain of the steamer was prompted to stop, which he did, but it turned out it was sailing under the flag of a neutral country and in fact was carrying cargo for Germany, so it was allowed to continue, with the warning not to use the radio, as this would be considered a hostile act. On the morning of the 5th of September, the British steamer Bosnia was sighted, which immediately radioed for assistance. The Bosnia was hit by several shots from the deck cannon, 8.8 centimeters, by the way, or 3.46 inches, the same caliber as used on a Tiger Panzer, for example. As the Bosnia came to a stop, a Norwegian ship approached and Preen asked if its captain to take aboard the British sailors, which in the meantime had boarded their lifeboats. And then from a distance of 600 meters, Preen ordered the launching of his first armed torpedo of the war. The Eel hit the Bosnia midship and it sank after only 1 minute. The next day it was the British steamer Rio Claro, which fell prey to U-47, and the day after the British steamer Gartavon. The crew of the Gartavon somehow managed to let their abandoned ship loose on a collision course with U-47. They probably fixated the rudder somehow. It was quite a close call for U-47, and it taught Preen a lesson. Even an unarmed steamer can be used as a weapon. He went after the lifeboats and asked the captain whether there were still crewmen on board the Gartavon. The British captain replied with, no, sir. Preen then told him that since he had committed a hostile act, he would not radio for their help, but would send a neutral ship for them once he had met one. After that, they sunk the Gartavon with the deck artillery only. It took them several shots to sink the ship, which was still sailing in circles. U-47 returned home after having sunk 8,270 gross registered tons of enemy ships. Back in Germany, Preen was called for a meeting with Karl Dönitz, at that time FDU, Führer der U-Boote or commander of the submarines. Dönitz asked him whether he thought it was possible for a single U-boat to enter the heavily guarded British naval base at Scapa Flow, located within the Orkney Islands, and attack British warships there. Preen was given all the available maps and data, and a few days to come to his own conclusion whether it was possible at all. Dönitz made it very clear that Preen was free in his decision. It was not an order to attack. If he would come to the conclusion that it could not be done, then that was it. After he made the necessary calculations and had thought it all through, Preen reported back to the Lion, Dönitz's nickname among many sailors. Dönitz looked at him for a while and then asked, "Yes or no, Preen?" "Jawohl, Herr Commodore," was Preen's reply. And so, on the 8th of October 1939, U-47 left for the Orkney Islands. Whenever they would sight the ship, they would submerge. But at night, they would run with both diesel engines at full power on the surface. None of the crew knew where they were going. When they reached the Orkney Islands on the evening of the 12th, the 1WO, the first watch officer, Endras, asked Preen, "Are we going to visit the Orkneys, Herr Kapitänsleutnant?" Preen was finally able to drop the secrecy and replied, "You better hold on to something, Endras. We are going into Scapa Flow." For a few seconds there was silence, and then Endras replied with a calm voice, "Das geht klar, Herr Kapitänleutnant. Die Sache geht klar." "That's all right, Captain. This thing will turn out fine." Preen writes that Endras could not have come up with any better words at this very hour. After telling the rest of the crew, he gave the orders. They're going to let U-47 rest on the seafloor for the night. All crewmen that are not needed are ordered to sleep if they can or otherwise rest to conserve oxygen. Explosive charges are put in place in case the operation fails. U-47 must not fall into enemy hands. After a last meal, they will not get any more warm food until the operation is over. Smoking is strictly prohibited. Then at 1900 hours, Preen gives the order to go to periscope depth. Slowly, U-47 rises. Preen looks through the periscope. Everything is calm and it's dark. Then he gives the order to surface. After the tower hatch is opened, fresh air streams into the boat. All seems quiet and no enemy ships can be seen. But even though it is dark, it feels like it is not as dark as it should be. And then Preen realizes that it is the Northern Light. They had chosen a new moon for the operation, and now the clouds in the north were lit up by the Northern Light. Nobody had thought of that. Yet, Preen ordered slow speed ahead. Delaying the operation is out of the question for him. After a while, a shadow is spotted, which could be an enemy vessel, so the alarm to dive is given. At periscope depth, they slowly proceed, and the mountains flanking their passage into Scapa Flow on either side loom higher and higher. They have to pass the wreck of a ship that was scuttled to block the passage they are attempting. They dive under the bow of the wreck, and the boat's antenna gets torn off, but they make it. They are inside the bay of Scapa Flow. After surfacing, they slowly proceed, and whenever they see one of the vessels guarding and patrolling the bay, they change course to avoid them. Then finally, Warensdorf, second watch officer, reports a very large shadow ahead. Preen gives the orders to get in closer. It seems to be a battleship. After a while, they see another one behind it, another ship. The one in front is identified as the Royal Oak. Preen orders all four bow torpedo tubes to be made ready for a surface launch, and only a few moments later they are reported clear. Preen orders a fan shot on the Royal Oak and a single shot on the other target. All torpedoes are ready to fire and Preen gives the order. Three torpedoes are running towards the targets. The fourth is a failure and doesn't launch. U-47 turns around to also launch the torpedoes in the aft tubes. But only one torpedo hits its target, the Royal Oak, and explodes. A giant fountain of water rises in the air where the torpedo hit. Preen is now faced with the decision whether to reroute the tubes and attack again, or head as quickly to the passage out of the bay as possible. He decides to attack one more time. This time, three more torpedoes find their target. Bright lights from the explosions can be seen, and several destroyers are now out to hunt for Preen. With full speed ahead, U-47 heads to the passage out of Scapa Flow, but the current is working against them, and progress is very slow. Against all odds, they make it. Behind them, they hear depth charges exploding. The British vessels must have thought their target was still inside the bay. 2 days later, the British Admiralty made the loss of the Royal Oak public. The other ship which was hit was the aircraft transport ship Pegasus. And they also reported that the enemy submarine is most likely destroyed. After they are back in Germany, Captain Preen and the crew are celebrated as heroes. Hitler orders them to be flown to Berlin, where he decorates Günther Preen with the Knight's Cross, and also decorates several other members of the crew with iron crosses. And Günther Preen was actually the first submarine captain to earn the Knight's Cross. Many combat patrols still followed after that, and in total, U-47 sank 30 Allied ships, totaling about 200,000 gross registered tons. In 1940, he was awarded the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross. Most of these successes were achieved against convoys of transport ships guarded by anti-submarine destroyers. The British kept getting better and better at detecting submarines and destroying them with depth charges. Life had gotten very hard for the German U-boat crews. On the 7th of March 1941, U-47 went missing. It was never established what precisely happened to them, but it may have been sunk by the British destroyer HMS Wolverine. It was quite a shock for Germany when Preen was reported missing. And for my last quote today and ending my report on Günther Preen, Dönitz wrote in the Order of the Day on the 23rd of May 1941, "Captain Preen, the hero of Scapa Flow and his brave crew, will live on in the hearts of all Germans."
What an amazing tale there. He does get spoken about still today. Didn't they make films about it? I mean, that daring raid into Scapa Flow, that was a huge symbolic victory. I mean, Orkney Islands is part of Britain. It's just at the top there on the north of Britain. That's right in the middle of the enemy territory, taking out, you know, the naval base. And it's an incredible symbolic victory there. And I didn't know that the Northern Lights could be seen there. I thought you had to be a lot further north than that. I didn't realise that they could be seen in the Orkney Islands. And I never really thought that storms would be a problem. If you're in a submarine, you just think, well, they can just submerge, surely. But I should imagine that they're actually limited with the amount of time they could spend submerged. Obviously, if they're travelling on the surface at night using the diesel engines, maybe it uses up more fuel if they're submerged. I guess it would do for the oxygen that's got to be produced. And living in those cramped quarters as well, you think of that small space that those men are living in together, you know, that they'd have to be a very strong character because small things would tend to wind people up a lot if you're in a small enclosed space with the same people. So you'd have to have a lot of self-control to not allow things to get to you. They must have been very, very brave men and deservedly won those awards. Dennis, have you got anything any comments you'd like to add to that?
Well, first of all, the thought of being in a submarine certainly doesn't appeal to me. I mean, to be caught, you know, being hit by the enemy in a submarine is, you know, 99%, it's going to be a problem. And plus the fact, the part when they said that the sailors were stunned when they heard about the war being declared, and that just goes to show that Hitler wasn't looking to rule the world, as many of these people who say that, you know, that it was financed by Wall Street and they were financing the war effort. All this went on before war was declared, and war wasn't even heard about till the, you know, the final days of the Polish escapade. So, yeah, I mean, no, if you're going to put me in a submarine, I'd probably be the last place I'd want to be.
Yeah, it'd be very easy to go stir crazy, wouldn't it? And I think that what you were just bringing up there, I mean, that shows you that the German people were not interested in war. Even the people that were part of the Navy didn't want to have a war. Nobody wanted to have a war in Britain either, especially not people that were in the armed forces. When they locked up the people that did protest against the war, I think one of the quotes was that there was more medals on the prison floor than had ever been seen at a Remembrance Day march, or words to that effect, meaning that all the protesters that were protesting against the war were all high up in the army. They were all people that knew what they were talking about and desperately wanted to avoid another war. Yeah, that was fascinating, Schmidt. Have you got anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Well, there were some subjects that you mentioned. The Northern Lights, they did not see the Northern Light directly. It was more that the clouds were illuminated by the Northern Light far in the north, and that was enough to make it more bright than it should have been that night. And a film was indeed made in post-war Germany about Günter Prien, but they ridiculously turned him into an anti-national socialist. And I've read only bad things about it, so I'm not even going to attempt to watch it. They did make a movie, by the way, also about Hans-Joachim Maxey, and that one is kind of watchable. They also distorted his story somewhat, but somewhat watchable. Curiously, after that, I think both those movies were made in the 50s. And after that, none of these German war heroes was ever portrayed anymore in a German film, as far as I know.
Well, they must have really captured the public's imagination. You know, they must have seen them as great heroes. That's why they wanted to make the film about them. But then if they were going to make the film about the hero, the public hero, then they had to smear him in some way or make him anti-national socialist. And that shows you just how big these people were, the fact that they did actually make a film about him. Even though they made him anti-national socialist, he was still a big enough character for them to warrant that. And I would say at least one good thing about those two movies, Schmidt, you should be able to find some footage from them to go with the documentary when you do them, I would have thought.
Yeah, I could scour them for footage, but I'm not sure they would fit because, the dogfights are not really that well made back in the 1950s.
Right.
I mean, and maybe some footage of the desert. Maybe I could use that for the Hans-Joachim Maxey movie. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much for that. These presentations are great. I'm sure you'll be able to find another one to find for us before too long now. Maybe not next week, because I know you're going to be working on the new video presentation. But with what we've got for listeners now, we've got a list of some of the best things that we think happened in 2016. Because we know people always seem to like it when we try and find something positive to end the podcast with. So we thought we'd do the last podcast of the year and end with lots of positive stuff. So we've got this list here, and there are contributions from all of us. And the first one that's on the list is Tyson Fury. Now, I know he's a bit of you're a big fan of Tyson Fury's, Dennis. So do you want to tell people what's so good about Tyson Fury this year?
Yeah, well, I can say for sure that He won the world title outright from Klitschko, who held it for above a decade. Went over to Germany and won it. And it speaks his mind, to be honest. And he's went on to a few subjects, such as how the New World Order and homosexuality and paedophilia all come into play. And he was heavily criticised, obviously, from numerous quarters, the usual tribe. Eventually, kind of gave up his belts because he does suffer from depression. But I'm assured that he's going to be back in 2017, looking to take his belts back again. He's already in training, as is his cousin Huey, who is looking. Mandatory world title fight with the guy from New Zealand who just picked up the world title. So yeah, all things looking good. And the fact is that, you know, the white race is under attack, and these are shining beacons of people who stand up and say what's right.
Yeah, Klitschko was a Jew as well, so yeah. he beat a famous Jew, and he wasn't politically correct. I mean, you say he's got depression. I'm sure the BBC certainly didn't help with that, with all their attacks on him. And because he was so successful, he should have been Sports Personality of the Year. And yeah. They prevented that from happening.
Because they gave it to one of the most boring tennis players ever known. So.
And all to do with political correctness. They said that he couldn't be a sports personality because he wasn't politically correct. And what has political correctness got to do with sporting excellence? Nothing to do with it. It's to do with who was the greatest British sportsman of the year. And that was clearly him. And, you know, it's very brave of him to speak up against homosexuality and feminism. And it's not something that most people are used to hearing on the BBC. So, you know, really good on him for doing that. And I hope he does recover from his depression and comes back fighting next year. Well, the next one that we've got on the list is probably one that everyone knows will be on the list. And that's Brexit. And also David Cameron leaving as Prime Minister. I know you were particularly happy about Cameron stepping down, Dennis. Do you want to give a few words on this and how you felt about it and where you think it's going?
Well, I never liked Cameron. I mean, he was just a Tony Blair mate too, and was actually a socialist in conservative clothing. So I wasn't sorry to see him go. Andy Zoppo, can't remember his name now, but he always reminded me of Count Dracula, to be honest. But yeah, the Brexit thing itself was a great result, unexpected to be sure. I didn't vote because I'm a great believer that the vote in this country is rigged, and I do believe even that was rigged. But it was such an avalanche of people wanting to leave that it couldn't possibly be rigged without them actually finding out. So you had the Brexit leaving, and then you had the campaign now, what's going on, where they're trying to slow things down, take things to court, and hoping that they can in some way either water the exit down or not exit at all, which would be an absolute scandal. But wouldn't surprise me.
It was incredibly uplifting to see. You think 17 million people voted for sovereignty, for Britain to be separate from the European Union. If you're separate from a union, then that means you have sovereignty, and it means you're a separate nation. Even though it was civic nationalism, it was still nationalism that 17 million people voted for. It's just that they're not yet aware of the ethnic component of it. And it's very sad to see the people twisting it now, and you've got people like the leader of the Liberal Democrats who is saying, oh, well, nobody voted to leave the single market. Nobody voted to leave the common market. But that's what the European Union was. That's what we were always told it was. Right. We were told that the European Union was the single market. So, yes, everybody did vote to leave the single market. And this fall in the Liberal Democrats, I don't know who he's trying to appeal to. His Christmas message, he gave that at Calais Refugee Centre. So maybe he should be over there in France talking to those constituents.
Because Liberals and Democrats, they've always been kind of, one of these parties you vote for if you're not happy. But come the election time, everybody goes back to the original party. But what was interesting, I found out the other day, was the fact that the European Army was announced the day after Brexit. They wanted to hold that back because they thought it might affect the vote. But even so, the people of Britain realised something was wrong. I'm not 100% sure they knew exactly what was wrong, which I explained in Communism by the Back Door. But they sensed something was wrong. They didn't like the fact that laws were being made and we were subject to them without any comeback. So they voted no, and rightly so.
And I was convinced that people were going to vote to leave. It seemed to me that all the people in my area that I spoke to and I asked whether they were going to vote to leave or stay, they all said they were going to vote to leave. And I was seeing all these polls and on the BBC, they were saying, the Remainers are going to win. And I thought to myself, well, I expect London will vote to remain, but I really don't think the rest of the country will. And the rest of the country didn't. And the most amazing thing was Wales, that received more money from the European Union than any other nation in Britain. And yet practically the whole of Wales voted to leave. You know, they put their children and their grandchildren's needs ahead of their own, because they had nothing to lose, the grandparents. They were, benefiting from this money, but they put their children's needs ahead of their own. So it's very sad to see them being knocked for this and saying, oh, these selfish old people, they voted and the young people wanted to stay. Because the older people were really putting the needs of the young ahead of their own. So I was very, very proud to see that, proud to live in Wales. And again, that was a vote for nationalism. We don't want to be a part of the European Union. So that was really the most positive thing for me on the British side of things. But the next one that we've got on here is the rise of the alt-right, which is, amazing, really, to invigorate a whole of white nationalism. It's mainly an American movement, but we all do feel a part of it here in Britain. I mean, it's more like a worldwide term. If you support white nationalism, if you're against immigration, if you're against feminism, multiculturalism, diversity, homosexuality, all the things that we're against, and you promote traditional values, then you are on the right, and you are now the alternative right, because the right has been co-opted by the people like David Cameron, like we were just talking about, this fake conservative. So the alternative is now the real true right, which is what we are. It's amazing to see the rise of that. And that leads on to the next subject, which was Donald Trump and the ascendancy of Donald Trump, which the alt-right gave a massive boost to, with all the memeing and all the songs and all the podcasts and videos that were made supporting him. And then the fall of the Hildebeest, seeing this spectacular fall from fame for Hillary Clinton, really. And it's just amazing to see that she was beaten. And the big highlight of that was all the corruption that was exposed in the Democratic Party. And it's, I just cannot understand now how they are having a go at Putin, saying he was responsible for it and that he should be punished for this, when if it was him, they should be thanking him. Surely Obama should be thanking someone who pointed out corruption in the Democratic Party. The fact that he is not thanking whoever it was that exposed that corruption shows that he is a part of that corruption. This is only logical. I really don't understand how the American people can let him get away with that, because he's basically saying he is part of a conspiracy to defraud the American public. But, you would think, wouldn't you, Dennis, that you would thank somebody that exposed corruption?
I think what stood out more than anything with the Trump election was the internet defeating the mainstream media. I mean, for a long time, we know that people have been leaving the mainstream news because people have lost hope with it. But this really did prove it, because the concerted campaign to stop Trump was so obvious in the mainstream, but yet the internet told a different story. And this is where a lot of people got their information from. And of course, the health issues of Clinton wasn't exposed in mainstream, certainly not on anything I saw. Only on the internet. So it was a massive, massive boost. And it's probably the reason why they're turning to look to tighten up on the internet,
Well, I think it really shows, the creative power that we have, our creative power and our intellect, genius among some of the people in the alt-right, managed to defeat all that money Billions, millions and millions were poured into Hillary Clinton's campaign, and nothing was poured into the alt-right. Donald Trump funded his campaign on his own, but the best support for his campaign came from just individual people making up songs, writing music, making videos, putting them out, putting all these memes out, all the tweeting that went on in support of him, all the trolling of the leftists that were supporting Hillary Clinton, mocking them, ridiculing them, making them look stupid. Hey, all of that was provided for free. And we defeated all that money. You know, that is one of the really positive sides of it, I think. And also, as you say, Dennis, it's an absolute triumph for the alternative media. And they're now forced to have it to accusing us of being fake news when, you know, we get our news reports in the same place as the mainstream media does. What they don't like is the conclusions that we draw from those news reports. We don't say, oh, this is a random isolated incident. We will say, well, no, this isn't random and isolated. It's exactly the same as the one that happened last month and the month before that and the month before that. All the victims were white. All the killers were Muslim. So no, it's not an isolated incident. And that's what they don't like. And again, you can see that what they're doing is they're throwing money into it. You've got George Soros funding these companies that are supposed to be checking out what's fake news and what's not. And basically what they're going to do is anything that parrots the mainstream media line, that's going to get thumbs up. And anything that promotes the alternative, that's going to get the thumb down. And I think that's just going to drive people away from places like Facebook and Twitter and onto Gab, because you're already seeing liberals and that type, leftist types, that are saying, you know, we don't want to be somewhere where we're in an echo chamber. We want to hear the views of other people. We've even had a couple of leftists and Antifa come in the chat room this week. Really? And it's been good because we've been able to debate them. And they really don't have anything that they can debate with, that they think we don't like people due to the colour of their skin. We don't like our skin colour. You know, I wear black T-shirts all the time. I'm not opposed to the colour black. You know, that's yeah. Seriously what they think, Dennis. Seriously.
Well, the problem is, in Wisconsin, early on this week, there was the rise of the Black Panthers again, and black gangs going around dragging white people out to cars and beating them up and wrecking the cars. So I think the tribe are pushing for another race war in America, which they probably, you know, there's a lot of these blacks will fall for it, and well, I just have to wait and see what happens. But it's certainly it's a backlash, I think, from losing that election, because to be honest, if Clinton had won it, I wouldn't have been surprised if we'd already be in the midst of World War III now with an all-fly zone over Syria.
Well, this leads us on to the next subject, which is the Assad Putin alliance, and just the fact, I mean, it's only been just over a year since Assad came in on the side of, or Putin rather, came in on the side of Assad in Syria, and just today they've had a peace conference, and within 24 hours they've got a peace deal. They've got a ceasefire, they've got a roadmap. They succeeded in doing it all within 24 hours that America has failed to do for the last 5-6 years. And within a year, they've managed to take back Syria and drive out the terrorists. So, of course, Obama is really butthurt over this. And he's accusing Putin of doing all this hacking, sending out, expelling these diplomats. And Putin is a masterstroke. Instead of sending away the American diplomats from Russia, he's let them stay, and he's even invited their children over for a Christmas party on New Year's Eve. Fantastic move there by Putin. It really has been Putin's year, I think, Dennis. I know you've got some thoughts on this as well.
Well, he's the ultimate chess player. I know a lot of people who believe in Adolf Hitler, etc., are quite wary of Putin. And they may have the reasons, but I've always said that actions speak louder than words. And when you look what he's done in Syria, he's actually stopped the New World Order, which is why there's been assassination attempts on him this year. But not only that, he's what he said he's done. And I've seen photographs on Google Images of Russian soldiers actually kissing the crucifix before going out into Syria. This you've got to remember, was a Christian army, which went into Syria and these rebels and ISIS, he sorted out where America and Britain were obviously just playing at the game.
Well, we saw the priests blessing the aeroplanes, didn't we? Before they were taking off, and Schmidt was saying about how seeing Christmas in Aleppo was a real high point of his year. But now that they've managed to take Aleppo back for the Syrian government, they can celebrate Christmas again. They can put their Christmas tree up. They can all go out there and give thanks. You know, he's done a really good thing there, Putin has, by doing that, and he really has shown up the New World Order, as you say. And the New World Order was exposed by yourself, Dennis, in your series, Communism by the Backdoor. And you finally finished that this year.
Yeah. Well, it was getting to be another marathon. Certainly went over, I think, around 5.5 hours, which, in a sense, was a follow-up from the first one, The Greatest Story Never Told. Just told the story from after the war up to present day, of how we got there, who got us there, and why. And so obviously Putin was always going to feature in that. And like I said, a lot of people were not sure about Putin, but I've always said this, you know, you look at the friends and you look at the their actions, and certainly Putin disowned Cameron and disowned Obama at one stage, and certainly sat down with them at one stage, but then decided enough was enough. Parties as always, and suddenly we got a host of propaganda from Britain and from America, leading up to Obama throwing his little pad, throwing the rattle out of the pram this week.
Yeah, it does seem to me like he's just trying to soil the nest before Trump gets in. Trump has sent a tweet out congratulating Putin on that move of his of not expelling the diplomats. Obama has got egg all over his face, and as you say, that your documentary, it did follow straight on from The Greatest Story Never Told, explaining how we had got there to that, and we had some good news about that this year as well. There was George Washington University and their program on extremism, and they did a huge study on Twitter and white nationalists, comparing them to ISIS, and they declared that Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, was the most tweeted relevant content in the white nationalist data set. So how about that, Dennis?
Well, I'll take that compliment.
That is a compliment. That's an excellent compliment. It's got to be the most watched World War II documentary in the world, I would have thought. Alternative one. Maybe otherwise on YouTube, when you think about it.
Is in any argument, you notice that documentary is now always quoted. It is the forefront of the argument where people say, well, if you don't believe me, go and watch TGNST, you know.
Well, I know you put a lot of work into making certain that everything that you put in there was backed up by facts, and you didn't put anything in there that wasn't backed up by, you know, more than one source, nothing that was, questionable. I can remember talking to you about that way back when we did the Behind the Reich series. People were asking questions about things because you just put the stuff that people could check, like when you were exposing the gas chamber hoax, up Fred Leuchter's work there, so that people could check that. The next one that we've got here, again, this is one from Messerschmitt, and this is to do with YouTube as well. This highlight of Messerschmitt's year was millennial woes being successful enough to do an American tour. Do you want to talk about that for a bit, Schmidt?
Yes, I've been following Millennial Woes videos for over a year now, I think. And he started out in a quite depressed way, talking about all the ills of the world and what was happening to Europe. And then I watched him getting more popular, and I never thought I'd see him do a public speech, but he did his first public speech in Holland at the Erkenbrand meeting, and he did really well. I mean, I was surprised how well he did out of his usual ways, as it were. And then at the NPI, he also held a very good speech. So he's a really good figure for our movement in my eyes.
Well, I think he's a very good ambassador for Britain as well. You know, going abroad and speaking at the alt-right conference, the NPI conference. I think that was a great conference. I think Richard Spencer did really well there. I mean, again, that was a highlight of YouTube year, really, was seeing that conference. And we have to thank Red Ice TV for producing that live link up so that everybody could watch that for free. I mean, Red Ice have done really well this year. They set up their TV station thing, so broadcasting live every Saturday with them in their studio, which you get if you pay the membership fees. But on top of that, they went round to all the conferences filming them with a live link up. They also did a live link up on the night that Donald Trump was elected. They obviously had faith that Donald Trump was going to get in, and they also filmed various demonstrations around the country and producing all of that for free on YouTube. And it's really important that we have our own media, that we can cover these events and demonstrations that we have, so that we have people that aren't biased against us that are there, so that we can then check what goes on from that. And also it's important to just to give support to the people that are going to those demonstrations. You know, not just 100, 150 people there, but you've got another 1,000 people that are watching on YouTube and giving their support. And the alt-right, white nationalism, it is a worldwide movement where we do support all the other nations that are standing up for white rights. And this links into a highlight of my year was the London Forum going national and international. You've now got regional London forums. You've got we had one in Wales this year. They've got the South West Forum. They've got the Yorkshire Forum. They've got the Scottish Forum. And now there's the North West Forum in America. And I think Greg Johnson is running that one. And they've had a couple of these forums that have gone down really well. And I think Jez Turner is an excellent spokesman for us. He gives some fantastic speeches, and he goes along to any demonstration where he's not a member of, or not explicitly a member of any political party. He will go along to any demonstration that's promoting white rights and stand up and speak for us and deal with the press. And he doesn't mind having his face put out there, his name put out there. Very brave of him, very courageous young man for doing that, I think. So a big thanks to Jez for everything that he does. And I've got some positive news from Radio Aryan as well. I mean, we produced our first video last month with that was yours, Messerschmitt, and hopefully we're going to produce more in the new year. And our listener numbers continue to increase, and we're easily getting about 50,000 listeners a week now, and that's continually gone up. So when we change from being Radio Stormer to Radio Aryan, it's just gone on a great big curve upwards basically since then. You can see that there was a huge lift in numbers around about March, April time. We've been far more successful since we've been Radio Aryan than when we were Radio Stormer. There's obviously still the same content, and most of the hosts are still the same. So I'd like to thank our hosts for sticking with us and for producing all the great content that they do. Especially Grandpa Lampshade and our new host Subal and Matthew Heimbach, who's not here this week, but who produces the Daily Traditionalist every day. And it is hard work to produce a live radio show every day. And we produce this one once a week. And you know the thought that goes into it, Dennis, and you, Messerschmitt. Messerschmitt's working all week long to produce a presentation for us. And then you've got someone like Matt Heimbach who does this daily. You know, so I'd like to say thanks to Matt Heimbach for doing that. Thanks to you too, Schmidt and Dennis, and thanks to all our other hosts and all our listeners, because, you know, you're the reason why we do this. We want to produce good content that improves your lives. We want to entertain you and inform you and educate you and bring you new ways of looking at the world that you hadn't thought of before. Which is pretty much what you do with your documentaries as well, Dennis. I mean, they were a big help to me in learning about what went on in World War II. And they were a big support to me as well. You know, when I realised Hitler was a Christian after reading Mein Kampf, you know, and you got a lot of anti-Christian people, and then your documentary was coming out, which was highlighting how Christian National Socialism really was. So it gives a lot of support. And that's what I want the radio network to do, so that people know that there are people that think the same way, that support you. Because we support nationalists of all types. Anyone that's standing up for their ethnicity and standing up for truth in history, then we support. Dennis, I don't know if you've got more to say. We've got a few minutes yet.
Well, I'd just like to say you've got to put yourself in that bracket as well, Sven. You do a fabulous job. I know you wear your heart on your sleeve and you speak it as it is. And, you know, you've got to put yourself in there and say a big thank you as well for producing what you do.
I appreciate that, Dennis. I couldn't do it without the radio hosts. Yeah, and Messerschmitt. I mean, he's a big help. He produces a third of the podcast for us sometimes, don't you, Schmidt?
It certainly does. Yeah.
He's disappeared. Well, he's gone all shy.
No, I'm here. I can only second what Dennis said. You are doing amazing work for all of us, basically. And doing what I do out of love for my people. How is that for a hater, as the media always wants to portray us?
That's right.
Well, that's it, isn't it? You know, we're just standing up for our people, and we do this out of love for our people, a desire to serve our people. This is why it's so sad when our people attack us and think that we're the enemy, when logically we're the ones that are speaking up for our own people. I mean, I've always questioned that. You know, why is it people attack these nationalists? You know, British nationalists, aren't they speaking up for the British people? Isn't that illogical, nonsensical, to go attacking them?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Well, this is why the left is always promoting the idea of shutting us down and silencing us, because they know that if people hear our message, they'll come to our message because it will resonate with them, because it's the truth.
Yeah, you're right. And all these policies they're bringing in, you know, which, you know, transgenderism and all this kind of carrying on, education at school, teaching kids about homosexuality at a young age, it's all, you know, the average person, especially, you know, in Britain and America, you know, doesn't want that to happen, and yet it's taken out of their hands. So, you know, we get that message across, then, you know, it's going to be even better for people to come over to our side.
Well, people know in their hearts that what we say is right, what we say is truthful, and they think, well, yeah, why am I promoting this sick disease of homosexuality? Why am I promoting the replacement of my own people? Why do I think it's wonderful if a white person breeds with a black person and you got a child with no heritage? You know, what's wonderful about that? These leftists just don't think like that. That's why they're so frightened of our message getting out there. And they are frightened. This is why, you know, we've seen these huge clampdowns this year. But everyone that has been to court, has refused to back down and has spoken to the court and addressed the court and told them why they are a nationalist. And by all accounts, you know, they've embarrassed the people in the court. But of course, we know that these judges are going to be biased against us. So unfortunately, some of them have gone down. But we also have seen a massive amount of letter writing and cards that got sent out to our prisoners of war. I'm sure every one of them must have been the envy of the rest of the prison, the amount of cards they received. You know, I know lots of people that sent out cards to just about everyone on that list that was produced. So thanks to everyone that did that. And thanks to all our supporters. And thank you, Dennis, for coming on. Thank you, Schmidt, for coming on. I'd like to wish you two both a happy new year, and also our listeners a happy new year, and we'll see you back here same time, same place next Friday on Radio Aryan for more Truthful Out Radio.
Listeners, a happy Christmas and a diversity-free new year.